Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to The Intercept, back in February, then-Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly directed immigration officials to portray unauthorized immigrants as criminals. According to emails between ICE and Texas officials, the agency attempted to construct a narrative to justify criminalizing immigrants. As ICE was preparing to launch its first mass raids under the Trump administration, officials received orders to document the three most egregious cases for each location, and local agents failed to meet the demands of the directive. The Intercept wrote that as it became clear that dozens of individuals with no criminal history had been apprehended, ICE shifted gears and told reporters that in addition to targeting safety threats, the raids were always meant to target those whose only crimes were immigration-related. Since Trump took office, ICE says agents have made 43% more arrests this year than this time last year. Between January and September, ICE has arrested more than 28,000 people for, quote, non-criminal immigration violations. That's a threefold increase from last year, according to the Washington Post. About 65% of individuals held by Homeland Security are in private facilities owned by companies who've seen their stocks soar since Election Day. And according to USA Today, Trump plans a massive increase in federal immigration jails. In recent weeks, ICE has put out requests to identify privately run sites in Chicago, Detroit, St. Paul, Salt Lake City, and Southern Texas. Joining me today to talk about the toll of Trump's immigration policy are two guests. Rachel Keast is an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Griselle Ruiz, a staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resources Center, where she focuses on the intersection between immigration law and criminal law. She's the Detention Advocacy Coordinator for the Northern California Chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and is board chair for CIVIC, a nonprofit that advocates for detained immigrants and is devoted to abolishing U.S. immigration detention. Griselle is a first-generation immigrant born in Mexico, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Griselle. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. My pleasure.
I want to ask you both how things have really changed since President Obama, who was often referred to as the deporter-in-chief. From 2009 to 2016, his administration oversaw the forcible removal of more than 3 million undocumented immigrants, most of whom were sent back to Mexico. According to Time magazine, neither Bill Clinton nor George W. Bush came close in reaching his tally over their two terms. Griselle, what are your thoughts on this? What has really changed since Trump took office?
You know, it's interesting. You can look at it in a lot of different ways. And in certain ways, a lot has changed. And in certain ways, not a lot has changed. So, you know, we were even talking right before the show about the state of affairs right now. And there has definitely been an increase in deportation since last year. Or rather, there's been an increase in ICE arrests since last year. So we are seeing more ICE arrests than last year. We are seeing more removal proceedings initiated, deportation proceedings initiated. But in terms of where we are now as compared to 2012, which is when we saw over 400,000 deportations, the highest figures that this country has ever seen. That was under the Obama administration, and we are not on pace to beat those figures this year. Of course, this administration has made it very clear that they do want to beat those figures and they want to surpass those figures and keep going. So that's definitely concerning. But in terms of where we are today, things were actually worse in 2012. Of course, I think that today there is a different feeling. It's hard to call it anything else but a war on immigrants when it comes to this administration. There's an antagony that we haven't felt previously. So that piece, I think, is new. And the fear that we're seeing in the community, I think, is at an all-time high.
I think also what's changed is the prosecutorial discretion that was announced in the Obama administration in November of 2014. That was a very detailed memo. These are the people that we intend on trying to remove. These are the people we do not intend on trying to remove. From my perspective as a public defender, that was an offensive document to begin with because it had people with certain convictions or arrests or other people involved, especially in the criminal justice system, who were very much on on the list. So I was opposed to that from the beginning, but now that has broadened to include anyone who has committed any illegal acts, which can and is including the way this administration is implementing the guidelines, anybody who has crossed the border illegally, anybody who's engaged in any criminal conduct whatsoever. So that's now everyone is what we're seeing. So whereas before, as a public defender, I could say these are the offenses that will put you on the list of people who are going to be prioritized for removal. These are the offenses that will not put you on the list. I can't say that anymore.
What do you think of the information that The Intercept uncovered? They published a number of emails between ICE and Texas officials showing how the Homeland Security Department attempted to construct a narrative to justify criminalizing immigrants. And this happened in February, according to these documents, under Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly. According to The Intercept, he was directed immigration officials to portray immigrants as criminals.
That sounds like just an extension of what started in 1996, really, when the Immigration and Nationality Act was amended so significantly to criminalize immigration. And I think that's what it's been about for very, very long, and now it's more explicitly so.
Even under the Obama administration, when he announced the DAPA program, the extension of DACA in Las Vegas several years ago, which unfortunately didn't survive, but when he made those announcements, he also announced changes to the deportation system. He announced that he was going to get rid of SCOM and introduce PEP, which references the memos that Rachel was just talking about. In other words, he was going to change the deportation system in a way that wasn't going to capture as many people. But during that announcement, he also used the framing, we're going after felons, not families. So I think what this tells us is that this administration is carrying on more of the same, certainly taking it to a new level, and we need to hold them accountable to that. But this framing as we're going after all of these terrible people as a justification for all of these terrible and lawless practices that we're seeing on the ground is definitely nothing new, unfortunately.
And all the detention, which is very much what this is about, I think, in a lot of ways, as you referenced in the lead-in there.
The detention, just in terms of the Trump administration looking for, according to USA Today, new privately run jail sites in Chicago, Detroit, St. Paul, Salt Lake City, and Southern Texas. And as we saw right after Donald Trump was elected, the stocks of these privately run prisons skyrocketed. I mean, they took a dive after Obama said that we're going to start closing these privately run prisons. So there's a lot of money that's being made right now on this.
I think it's very profit-driven.
There's the profit motive is really, I think, a disgusting undertone of all of this, because you're in a situation where you're truly profiting, you're truly pitting people over, you know, against profits, and guess who's going to win out in this circumstance, especially because here the people that we're talking about are people of color, are people who are largely represented. California, luckily, has taken a stand against this. So State Senator Ricardo Lara pushed SB 29, which was signed by the governor. It was actually co-sponsored by Civic and the ILRC. But that bill essentially says that California will not enter into any new private contracts in the future, which is huge to have the most immigrant-rich state in the nation take a stand on this issue. We hope that this will trigger other states to do the same, but it's great to see at least California take a stand.
Since Trump was elected, Geo Group's stock price has increased 63%. Core Civics has risen 81%, according to USA Today. And Brave New Films has a new documentary out called Immigrant Prisons. And they report that over the past 20 years, CCA and Geo Group, two of the largest for-profit prison companies, have made over $44 billion in revenue. Detention cost taxpayers about $2 billion in 2015, with no accountability for how these dollars are spent. The film also points out that George Zoli, the CEO of the Geo Group, brings in about almost $5 million a year, $4.8 million to be exact, and Damon Hinglinger, the CEO of CCA, brings in about $3 million a year. Do you think that this angle, Griselle, gets enough attention when we're talking about immigrant crackdowns?
No. You know, I think that we, it's so important when you, to look at the motives of what's happening today. Because think about it. You're seeing an increase in immigrant jails. You're seeing an increase in ICE arrests because you need bodies to fill those jails. So what do you need to do to fill the, to get those bodies? Well, you need to tick up deportation numbers. You need to tick up ICE arrests. And you know what? You can engage in more... in more bad practices when you're doing those arrests if you follow this rubric of, oh, we're deporting felons, not families. So now everybody look away when you, when we engage in all of these unsavory tactics on the ground. Look away when we're tearing families apart, not even abiding by the Constitution when we're doing so, because another important undertone is that ICE agents actually don't abide by the Constitution in the same way they should. Yeah. We still have constitutional protections in civil immigration, but you see them trampling over the Constitution all the time when they're engaging in ICE arrests. But going back to the original point, I think that the profit motives are an important point to look at, and it's actually something that we see in all circumstances. We see it in our private immigration jails, but we also see it in our public immigration jails. In California, we also have a lot of local county jails that actually rent out beds to ICE, and they are actually getting money. They're getting a per diem for those beds. Those contracts actually are part of those sheriff's budgets.
What would you add on that point, Rachel?
Nothing, just that the first, that you already addressed this, but that the way to get public support behind essentially handing over 43 or whatever billions and billions of dollars to these private corporations is to make everyone fear immigrants, to, you know, and that's what we're seeing in the I always think about how one of the very first things immigration wise that the Trump administration did was to promise resources and support to those who've been the victims of immigrant crime, as if that was our biggest problem, you know. And it was only a way of drumming up this idea among the public that immigrants are to be feared, when of course we know that they're not.
At this time, there are over about 200 immigrant prisons in the country. Is that about right?
I couldn't say it. That wouldn't surprise me.
Something in the neighborhood of 200 or 300.
Mm-hmm. And according to Brave New Films documentary and a number of articles, there are about 34,000 immigrants in prisons on any given day. I've also seen a number as high as 41,000.
Yeah, that range is about right.
And the U.S. locks up about 440,000 immigrants a year. So what, I know everybody's experience is different, but what really stands out for you about the experiences? What happens after someone is arrested by ICE and is sent to one of these jails?
Can I back up a little and
please
say that sometimes, often, they're not arrested by ICE. They might be arrested, but I mean, people are arrested by ICE in their homes, at their workplaces all the time. But very often as well, people are arrested by police. People might be arrested by police for charges that are never filed. People might be arrested by police for charges that are filed and then dismissed. Those people nonetheless go into the law enforcement database system, and ICE will come get them because they will file a notification request with the sheriff's office. The sheriff's office will notify ICE when that person is set to be released. Again, that person might be released because no charges were filed, or because the charges were dropped, or because they were convicted of a, you know, pled guilty to get out of jail to a very minor charge or a serious charge. Who knows? Either way, ICE is coming to get that person. So sometimes, and often I'd say, it is more local police doing the work of arresting people for who knows what and getting them funneled directly into ICE.
And I should say that 200 immigrant prison number comes from the Department of Homeland Security. Today, we are talking about immigration, and there are so many angles here. What has really changed under Obama, who was often referred to as the deporter-in-chief? And some things have changed, some haven't changed. From 2009 to 2016, Obama's administration oversaw the forcible removal of more than 3 million undocumented immigrants. Most were sent back to Mexico. According to Time magazine, neither Bill Clinton nor George W. Bush came close in reaching that tally. So we're talking about what has changed under Trump, how ICE has been emboldened, what are the conditions in these for-profit prisons where companies are bringing in a lot of revenue. Their stocks rose right after Trump was elected. We're also going to talk about how people are treated in prisons and what happens after they are deported from the United States. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Our guest, Griselle Ruiz, says fear is at an all-time high. If you are in a community and you have felt this fear, if you are an immigrant, if you work with immigrants, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Griselle Ruiz is a staff attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Rachel Keast is an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office. And let's hear from Roberta in San Leandro. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you again for another great show. I just wanted to comment, you know, and I'm Mexican and French American, both, you know. So I think this seems awfully like a vendetta, you know, for Mexican, Central American, South American people. My point was also that we know there are many Russians and, you know, you name the other country in the world who are coming here illegally. So why aren't they after them too? I mean, this just seems pointedly wrong. To begin with, but, you know, you see my point, I guess.
Right.
It seems, you know, focused to just Mexicans and South Americans and Central Americans in saying that, you know, the people that we actually all rely on, let's be fair, to do work that many of us aren't capable of. I can't be in a field for 12 hours a day. If I had to, but, you know, you see my point. Everybody that we have here, who comes here, my family's came here for a better life, like everyone else is trying to do. Mm. And now we're trying to shut that whole beautiful point of what America was down. Mm. And that is incensing me, it incenses all of us, I believe.
Well, thank you for that question, Roberta. Do we have a breakdown of where people who are arrested come from?
There is online, the DHS actually publishes which people are getting, how many people are getting removed to each country. I don't have it on me, but
I think that does touch on another point, though, is the fact that, you know, who are these numbers, right? It's so easy for us to toss around figures. X number of people were removed this year, X number of people were removed that year. But when you really break down who those people are, we're talking about, as Roberta mentioned, not just folks who are from Mexico. We're talking about folks who conceivably are from many, many different countries. We're also not just talking about undocumented people. We're also talking about green card holders. We're also talking about refugees. We're also talking about asylees. We're talking about children. Children can be deported without an attorney. So when, you know, it's so easy for us to toss around these numbers, and I actually have to remind myself to do this, to really talk about who, these aren't just numbers. These are families. These are parents. These are siblings. And these are people from all sorts of different immigration statuses, too.
If I could just add to that, so you mentioned, Griselle mentioned that there's people with no attorneys, children, not only just children with no attorneys, but, you know, 90-95% of the people who are in removal proceedings who don't have attorneys, which is why we are happy to have expanded our program recently and are trying to do as much as possible along with other organizations such as the San Francisco Public Defender's Office and the other organizations involved in our partnership in Alameda County. I would love to speak a little bit, too, if we can, about what happens to people, and this was what you had originally asked, once they are in ICE detention. I started with how they get into ICE detention, which is very often through local police. But then once they're in ICE detention, I want people to know what that involves. It often involves being taken very far away from their families to these private or, you know, or public detention centers that are in other places in California, or in Texas or in Arizona, or sometimes even farther away than that. Again, most people do not have an attorney through this process. You are not guaranteed an attorney the way you are in the state system for a criminal proceeding. phone calls are often hard to come by. Not only are they expensive to family members, but they're very difficult to arrange even to your attorney. Sometimes we have that problem all the time. And of course, as in almost in any detention situation or prison or jail, there's violence and it's dangerous. And I just wanted to point that out. That's how these proceedings are initiated against people in detention. There is a bond process that you can ask for a bond, but you have to not only be able to pay a bond. It's a high bond in the, you know, let's say $5,000 to $10,000 to $15,000 range, which you must pay 100% of, unless you can have some collateral. If you have a house, that you can get a bail bondsman to pay it. And you're likely going to be trying to fight to stay in this country without an attorney and far away from your family. And if you don't get a bond, you're looking at many, many months and potentially, depending on the situation, even years in custody trying to stay in the U.S.
Can you talk about who makes these decisions? If you're sent far away from your family and your children, who makes that decision?
An ICE officer. That's it.
And is there any consistency or?
Not really. I mean, we find that if we enter a case and we're involved in a case, that generally people will stay locally, but it is truly at their whim and at their discretion.
And what is the process involved in letting the family know what happened? So if a father is taken away from a family, does his partner, his wife have, was she able or he able to get information about where their partner went, how long they'll be away? I mean, what about that?
There's no process by which ICE notifies a family member. So they could go arrest me at my home, and they will make no effort to inform my husband. They won't make any effort to inform children, to check if there are children, to see if they're taken care of. It's essentially, I mean, certain people will describe this as kidnapping. You're essentially taking someone, not notifying anybody, and then leaving that family in shambles. And this is totally all at ICE's discretion, too.
How are these arrests happening? Some of the high-profile arrests get media attention when there's, for example, immigrants living in the same building. You see a midnight crackdown. How are the arrests happening right now?
From homes, they wind up doing the same MO. It's, you know, 4:30 in the morning. They'll go to people's homes and what we've been seeing, and in fact, there's a letter that was written by the American Immigration Lawyers Association and signed by 8.5 pages of organizations about how there's a ruse that there's a human trafficking crackdown. And what that has wound up being in some cases is simply just families who have been helping family members cross the border illegally. So they're calling that human trafficking. But really, it's pretty ordinary families doing what they have to do.
And I'll just add that in terms of how people are being captured today, still the number one way that people are funneled into the deportation system, as Rachel was referencing earlier, is by cooperation with the criminal justice system. So someone is arrested for whatever thing. Charges could even be dismissed, and oftentimes those individuals will then be passed on to immigration for removal proceedings. That's still the number one way that people are funneled, which is why bills like SB 54, the California Values Act, are so incredibly important, because they push back on some of that police-ICE collaboration. In addition to that, there are home arrests, there are arrests out in the street. We're also seeing an uptick in people getting arrested during their ICE check-in. So there might be a circumstance where an individual has a deportation order for whatever reason, their case has been closed, or maybe the government isn't able to remove them, and they have these regular ICE check-ins, and ICE is arresting people in those ways as well.
It kind of goes back to what Roberta was saying in her question about who this is happening to. Why isn't it happening more across the board? And the answer is really, since it does depend so much on local law enforcement, the people who are getting funneled into ICE are the policed communities, and those tend to be communities of color. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you expect will happen from here when it comes to arrests? Because just recently, Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Tom Homan spoke at the Conservative Heritage Foundation and said that he has directed the agency to possibly quintuple worksite crackdowns starting next year. Do you have any information on that?
No, I mean, it's in retaliation for the protective legislation that California has passed, I think. I don't have any inside information on it, but it does not surprise me, sadly.
It's absolutely retaliatory. And we even saw the federal government make similar statements after California, after our governor signed SB 54. I think what's important to note is that we can't give in to this fear mongering. We can't give in to these fear tactics. In fact, this is the time when it's most important to stand up and protect communities. And I think it's important for people to remember that even in these times, we do have protections that we can rely on. So, for example, with the example that you just brought up with the worksite enforcement, workers or employers can rely on the Constitution to push back. So, for example, if an ICE agent comes to a workplace, if it's private property, then that employer can say to the ICE agent, I'm not going to allow you in unless you have a valid warrant. We actually have a guide on our website specifically for employers on this issue. In other words, what can you do? What good practices should you be following to ensure that you protect your workers, following the law but still protecting your workers in these circumstances? And California also really recently passed a bill on this topic, and I'm afraid I forget the exact number, but there is actually a relevant bill that the state just passed on this issue.
Well, coming up after the break, we are actually in the process of getting immigration statistics to let you know where people who've been arrested have come from. Because, Roberta, I hope you're still listening, but you make a really good point, and this is another issue that doesn't really get much attention. We will also talk about how people are treated in these for-profit private prisons. Today, we're talking about immigration with Griselle Ruiz, staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and Rachel Keast, an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up a little later in the show, we will continue our coverage on the Northern California fires by checking in with Santa Rosa Junior College to find out how students and faculty who have lost their homes are coping. And then tomorrow, in a related show, we're going to talk about the best way to help when disasters happen. A lot of people don't know where to pitch in, what group to sign up with, where to give money. There's been a lot of controversy over how large organizations like the Red Cross handle their efforts and their funds. So we'll talk about that. And then there's so much crowdfunding now, it's almost overwhelming. So we're going to talk about the best way to get involved and find out how money is spent. And then on Thursday, we will be doing a show that is very directly related to today's show. We're going to have a conversation with Sasha Polakow-Saransky about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. Today, we are talking about how ICE has been emboldened under Donald Trump. But it is important to note that under Barack Obama, from 2009 to 2016, his administration oversaw the removal of more than 3 million undocumented immigrants. Most were sent back to Mexico. And today's guests say that some things have changed under Trump, but a lot has not changed. And we're joined today by Griselle Ruiz, staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. She's the detention advocacy coordinator for the Northern California chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and board chair for CIVIC, a nonprofit that advocates for detained immigrants and is devoted to abolishing U.S. immigration detention. We're also joined by Rachel Keast, an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Leave a tweet at yourcallradio. Let's talk about how people are treated in these for-profit prisons. And I want to play a clip from Brave New Film's short documentary called Immigrant Prisons. I think it's up at our website. If it's not, we'll put it there right after the show. It's 15 minutes, and they do an amazing job of just looking at how people are treated in prisons, the profits, and so many of the other issues that we're discussing here. Here is a clip from that documentary, Immigrant Prisons.
Innocent people are being locked up.
The explosive growth of a system of immigrant detention centers that few Americans know anything about.
What we are hearing is horrible.
I want my daddy back.
Forced to work for a dollar a day or less
which is a clear violation of anti-slavery laws.
This is not criminal custody. This is not someone who's been convicted of a crime.
Immigrant detainees awaiting deportation have routinely received substandard health care, poor food, unsanitary water, and unhygienic conditions at privately operated for-profit facilities.
And people are going to die. We already have people dying in detention centers throughout the nation.
Shares in the two largest private prison stocks jumped up November 9th, the morning after Donald J. Trump was elected president.
They're profiting off the misery of human beings.
That is a clip from a new short documentary from Brave New Films called Immigrant Prisons. Just to give some of the people a voice who are in these detention centers, they told the story of Tekla, who spent 10 months at the Adelanto Detention Center in California, where 1,600 immigrants are locked up. She said being in the detention center felt like illegal kidnapping. She said there was hate and humiliation. Nicole Hernandez Polanco said, quote, "One time I exploded and asked immigration, why do the guards touch me in a sexual way? I came here seeking asylum in this country because I didn't want to suffer anymore. And here I am going through it all over again." Speaking of sexual assault, between 2010 and 2016, there were 33,000 complaints of sexual and physical abuse. In California, there were more than 4,500 complaints, but the federal government investigated only 45 of these complaints. How pervasive is this? And why does the federal government, are they only investigating a tiny percentage of these complaints?
It's incredibly pervasive. These issues are not uncommon. In California, we have around 10 some odd detention facilities, immigration jails. You know, from in the advocate world, we often call them detention centers, but we should call them what they are. They are jails. They are jails where we hold people in civil proceedings months, sometimes years, without attorneys. Children. Also, in California, we have one of the only secure detention centers. In other words, we have a jail where we hold children. So we have a juvenile facility in California as well. And these issues that you talk about, the medical neglect, so bad, in fact, that we have had multiple deaths out of Adelanto, which is the largest immigration jail in California, among the largest in the nation. These issues are incredibly pervasive. And earlier this year, actually in June, I mentioned SB 29, which pushed back on private immigration jails in California. We also had AB 103, which was also pushed by Senator Ricardo Lara and also supported by many advocates on the ground. That is a new law, which is law right now, which says that we will not have any new public contracts, and also importantly provides the first state-funded mandate to the Attorney General to do oversight of all of these facilities. So moving forward, our Attorney General actually has funds and a mandate to do oversight of all of these facilities because clearly the federal government isn't doing that.
According to the Brave New Films documentary, since the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and ICE in 2003, there have been 177 reported deaths in these immigration jails. In 2014, DHS received 1,350 medical complaints, but they only investigated 90. The denial of care is routine, according to several people interviewed. And to give a name to people who have died in these jails, Roberto Medina died from a cardiac arrest. Boubacar Ba died of a traumatic brain injury. Neri Romero died from asphyxia. And Yusuf Oman died of cardiac arrest. Wrongful death lawsuits have also been filed against these private prison companies, CCA and the GEO Group. Can you talk a little bit about this?
I was just thinking, you know, you have to think that the level of impunity with which an officer who works in these immigration jails can act, not only knowing that most people are isolated from family and in one of the most vulnerable positions you can be in this country, but also that they're banking on the fact that this person might be out of the country soon and really can't take any action against what might happen to them in detention. So as bad as our system of prisons and jails in the United States is for U.S. citizens and others who are in that system, imagine the impunity these officers must feel for these people who are in an even more vulnerable position.
And Shane Bauer from Mother Jones has done a lot of reporting on this, and he has reported that in order to increase profits, they either cut back on staffing or just don't hire the people that are needed to deal with these medical problems and so many other issues in these jails.
I worked in I worked at the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project in Arizona. I was a staff attorney at the Eloy Detention Center. 2,500 people, 1,500, I can't remember. And yeah, it was daily that I heard the abuses. And that was years ago, but it's only gotten worse.
And it gets so bad that people will actually give up on their cases, which is, All of this is heartbreaking, in particular when it gets so bad that people actually die. But it's also incredibly common to see people give up on their cases. And I'm talking about people who have meritorious cases, people who could have won an asylum case. And imagine that. You have an asylum case. That means that you're facing potentially horrible things in your home country, but you're being treated so poorly in this country that you would rather go back and face whatever is waiting for you at home.
I've seen people with U.S. citizen claims to United States citizenship, who just couldn't take another day in detention, people who may have never had an encounter with law enforcement before.
The other thing that you learn about watching this short documentary is that in addition to the emotional distress, there's a lot of physical distress because a lot of people in these jails are malnourished. One woman said that you eat in the morning, afternoon, and you starve at night. And so there's also that element. Or it takes a toll just on your overall well-being.
Absolutely. It takes a toll on so many levels. Another thing, too, is the use of solitary confinement, which is something that we see in a lot of facilities as well. This is something that's especially an issue with folks who are transgender or gay. They'll be placed in solitary confinement supposedly for their own good, when in reality, can you imagine being placed in solitary confinement and what that does mentally to people? That's another area where you see a lot of people just give up on their cases because they simply can't handle another day of that abuse.
Important to recognize, again, this is a civil detention. This is essentially the way I liken it to if you were accused of not paying your taxes and now you're having an audit done, that's a civil proceeding against you. But if we took those people and locked them in prison for months and years.
Rachel Keast is an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office, and Griselle Ruiz is staff attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Today we are talking about immigration, ICE, these for-profit prisons over the past 20 years. CCA and the GEO Group have made over $44 billion in revenue. Detention cost taxpayers $2 billion in 2015 with no accountability for how that money is spent. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Pamela in West Marin. Hi, Pamela. Welcome to the show.
And thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful program. I have a question, and then I'd like to share a resource with you, if I may. Maybe I'll share the resource first, then I'll ask the question, and you can run with it. The resource is a film that we just showed out here in West Marin, and it's called Por Qué Venimos, and it's a film of immigrants in the canal in San Rafael, and it talks about why they left their countries and their experience of getting here. It's heart-wrenching, very well done, Por Qué Venimos. And we showed it to a predominantly Anglo audience with Latinos also, and it was wonderful the way we all came together to discuss it. So that's the first thing. And then the second, my question is, I understand there's a prison in Pinole, and that's close to us, and I'd like to know if that is the case, and how do we influence that.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Pamela. We'll find information on the film and put it on our website. Are you familiar with the prison in Pinole?
I believe that Pamela's referring to the Contra Costa contract.
In Richmond,
yeah. We're in San Francisco today. The fact that some of this is going on a stone's throw away, I think is something that's often shocking to people. So up here in Northern California, for folks who appear in San Francisco court, they will be detained in one of four facilities, the closest of which is in Contra Costa. That's a county contract. So the county of Contra Costa actually rents out beds to ICE. We have another contract with the county of Sacramento, another one in Yuba County, which is a drive from Sacramento, and then another one in Mesa Verde, which is Bakersfield, which is actually closer to LA, closer to the immigration court in LA, but they appear via video up here in San Francisco. And the Mesa Verde, that's actually a private contract. That's actually something we haven't quite discussed yet, the use of video, but people will sometimes, often actually, it's becoming more the norm now that people actually will appear for their hearings via video. So whether or not you're detained more close to San Francisco, whether or not you're detained down in Bakersfield, you may be unrepresented, and then you may not even be physically in front of a judge. You may be appearing via video.
So the judges who are making life and death decisions for people are not even looking them in the eye. They're looking at a video for the most part.
For people who are transferred to jails far away from home, do they have access to lawyers? What's that process like?
No, they don't. Often there might be some lawyers who, through some organization, are offering limited services in some of these places, like our organization or other organizations. And if they can pay for an attorney, they can have their attorney. However, when they're transferring people so far away, so Yuba County is a very common place where our clients are detained. That's many hours away. If there's traffic, it's very hard to tell. And telephone is a huge issue. Access to telephone calls for attorneys, they're often monitored and they shouldn't be, or they can't get phone calls at all. So, yes, if you can pay for an attorney or if you happen to luck out and get an attorney whose services are provided for free, yes, you can have an attorney, but most people don't.
What are the conditions like here in California? A lot of the jails that were discussed in the Brave New Films documentary were in southern Texas. What are the conditions like in California?
They're quite bad. So in California, again, we have about those 10 facilities. They're all sort of varying. They all sort of have their issues. So Adelanto, for example, that's the largest facility in the state. It's a private facility. That facility has seen multiple deaths. We've seen medical neglect be a huge problem in Adelanto. Theo Lacey is a public facility down in Orange County, also has a lot of issues. Even federal government inspections have found moldy food, have found really deplorable conditions in terms of what people are given to eat. Up here in Northern California, the Contra Costa facility actually has huge problems in terms of the way it treats women. We're hearing that a lot of women are giving up on their cases because of their treatment. Rachel, I don't know if you have anything to add.
I don't have anything to add, yeah. I definitely hear stories.
How long are people held in these facilities? In the film, Sylvester Owino from Kenya said he spent 9 years and 4 months in an immigration detention. A couple other people, Gerardo, said he was locked up for 11 months at the Adelanto Detention Center here in California, where he had a very severe urinary tract infection. He needed immediate care. They were ignoring his requests. They finally took him to a hospital, and the doctor said if you had waited 2 or 3 more days, you would have died. That's here in California.
Yeah.
How long do people stay in these jails?
You know, it really varies. And I think it can vary, too, depending on if someone has counsel. But I think what we're seeing on average is several months. It can be years, depending on if somebody appeals their case. So let's say you lose your case in front of the immigration judge, or let's say you win, but the federal government appeals. You have to remain detained during that appellate process, which, of course, is a deterrent, right? Can you imagine if someone is unrepresented, they try their hardest and they lose their case, but they want to keep fighting? Can you imagine what somebody must be thinking if they think, well, I continue fighting my case, that's another 3, 4, 5, how many, X number of months. Now I've been in detention for over a year in these horrible conditions. It's a deterrent to justice, as though there aren't already enough barriers set up in the system.
We do have some favorable law, especially in the Ninth Circuit, but that's being challenged right now. In fact, it's right now before the United States Supreme Court. right now in the Ninth Circuit, after a six-month detention period, you have the right, if you were determined not to qualify for a bond at the beginning, you have a right to another hearing for a bond in front of an immigration judge, where you may or may not convince that judge that you're not a dangerous person, quote unquote. And so you may or may not get a bond, but at least you have the chance to convince the judge at that point. But that is very much under threat by the United States Supreme Court right now, and we don't know how that's going to go.
How will California's sanctuary state bill that was designed to protect immigrants without legal residency affect immigrants?
You know, SB 54, the California Values Act, really provides a great foundation from which to build on. So what's unique about this bill is that it's much more comprehensive than previous bills. So it will definitely provide more protections than we've seen in the past. That said, there's still a lot of work to be done. Basically, what SB 54 does is it pushes back and it says that our local law enforcement isn't allowed to cooperate with ICE in the same way. It basically tells local law enforcement, hey, focus on local resources. Let the federal government do its bad bidding on its own. Let's not be complicit in that system. So it does that through a bevy of ways. It's quite a large bill. That said, you know, there is still some discretion for local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE in certain scenarios. But the good thing is that SB 54 also makes clear that local governments are free to pass the strongest policies possible. So we have this new state standard. Local governments can still go stronger, can still go higher. And from an advocate perspective, that's our job from here on out, is to push our leaders to go as strong as they should.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing how local counties and communities will put an even higher standard to cooperate even less with ICE.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. We're doing a show about immigration on Thursday, and it looks like we found some numbers from the Department of Homeland Security, but they're not broken down that simply. So we need a little bit more time to analyze these numbers, and we'll hopefully bring them to you on Thursday's show. Rachel Keast is an immigration attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office, and Griselle Ruiz is a staff attorney at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Thank you both for coming in, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
And coming up in just a minute, we will continue our coverage of the Northern California fires by speaking with Ellen Mermont Silver of Santa Rosa Junior College to find out how students and faculty who lost their homes in the fires are coping. This is Your Call. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. In the coming weeks and months, we will continue covering the devastating fires in Northern California, find out how different communities are coping. And joining us now is Ellen Mermont Silver. She's Public Information Officer with the Santa Rosa Junior College. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. I understand that SRJC opened yesterday. How many students lost their homes in the fires?
Well, we know that about at least 600 students have lost their homes, which is a mind-boggling number to me, to all of us. Mm. These are students who, as we like to say, we accept the top 100% of all who apply. That means we have every kind of student. We already had some homeless students in the hundreds. We have also many transfer students are going on to Ivy League schools all over the place, but we have a lot of undocumented students. We have a lot of students who are first-generation college students. I think your listeners will get the picture.
That is such a huge number, at least 600. How are those students coping at a time when, even before the fires, real estate in Santa Rosa was hard to come by and also very expensive?
Yeah, we had a 1% vacancy rate before these fires. So needless to say, it's a huge problem right now. The interesting thing to me is we sent out a survey to all of our students, and within the most recent count was 16,000 have responded. That's a phenomenal number right there out of our 27,000 students this fall. And what they told us was they can't wait to get back to class. 80% said, I'm ready on Monday. So a large number of these students were affected, but only a few, a small proportion, like 20% said seriously impacted. 79% or so said somewhat impacted. Well, we were all somewhat impacted. So that may mean they evacuated once, twice, or more. It may mean some people have lost their jobs because the owner of the company lost their home. So there's this huge ripple effect. At the same time, students really want to get back to work. They're here for a reason. They are not dawdling here. They have a goal. They have a purpose. They have families. Many, many parents go to school here, young parents, old parents. And so they have something to do here, and they want to get it done, and they're here.
600 students lost their homes. How about faculty?
Well, we have more than 60 faculty and staff, including people who work in offices, people who work in admissions and records, wherever they work. But 60 faculty and staff have lost their homes, and at least 15 retirees. And our hearts really go out to them, too. You know, these are people who worked here, many of them 20, 30, 40 years.
Wow.
And they're part of our family. And it's just breaking our hearts. But the resiliency of people up here is quite impressive.
The SRJC Fire Relief Fund has been established to support students and employees with urgent needs. And as of about a week ago, there was about $100,000 in that foundation. I'm guessing that the number has gone up. How are you doling out this money? On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk specifically just about how these funds are distributed.
Well, you know, unlike a GoFundMe account, we have a long-established foundation. Actually, it's the number one foundation in all of California community colleges for fundraising. Hmm. And so they have a very established way of distributing funds. In this case, at this point, we're giving out $500 to everybody who lost their home. That doesn't sound like much, and it isn't much. We'd love to give them $5,000, but we don't have that to give. But we are giving $500. We'll see if we can make more of that. And well, right now, the entire fund, with all the lead donations from Redwood Credit Union in conjunction with the Press Democrat, which is our local daily paper and online pub, and Exchange Bank, and all the small gifts, we're up to almost $400,000 now.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So that's great.
Mm. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll definitely check in the coming months.
Well, Rose, I appreciate it. Can I give the URL of our website in case somebody wants to donate to help these students?
Yes, please.
It's firerelief.santarosa.edu, or if you just go to santarosa.edu, you'll see it on the homepage. We really appreciate your support and would love to talk to you soon.
Firerelief.santarosa.edu. All right. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Rose. Have a good day.
You too. Ellen Mermont Silver is Public Information Officer with Santa Rosa Junior College. It's an amazing JC up in Santa Rosa. They also have classes in Petaluma. They've got over 27,000 students. 600 have lost their homes, and 60 faculty members have lost their homes. In the coming weeks, we'll continue to check in with a range of people who've been affected by the Northern California fires. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.